It was all those customers bringing their stuff and talking with us about it. As I listened to them, I realized there was a story here that was about more than repair or even this business model or even overconsumption or even climate change. There was a story about stuff that I was interested in telling, and I thought that I might have something new to add to the conversation because of this weird intersection of theater and repair and climate change work.
Welcome to Social Entrepreneur. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former Fortune 500 executive, but today I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. We hear exciting stories of ordinary people just like you who are making a difference. They share their successes, their failures, and what they're learning along the way. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome back to Social Entrepreneur. And today's guest, Sandra Goldmark, the author of Fixation. Now, Sandra has this interesting background. She's the Director of Sustainability and Climate Action at Barnard College. She has a theater background, and she ran a repair shop called Fix Up for 7 years. And she's going to tell the story of Fix Up and how it led to this book, Fixation. But listen for these things in her startup story about Fix Up, about how they just decided to run the experiment, and about the importance of this mobile shop and how that works in her neighborhood, and then how she structured this like an event and connected with the community. And the other thing that I like about it is she's learning from other models, such as the food movement. So she's taken everything she's learned from all these different things, and she's put them together into this great new book called Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. So here she is to tell the story, Sandra Goldmark.
Hi, I am Sandra Goldmark. I am a theatrical set designer. I'm a professor at Barnard College. I'm the director of sustainability at Barnard. I'm a mom. I am a short-term repair shop owner, and I'm the author of Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet.
Your short-term repair shop is called Fix Up, and the book is called Fixation. So take me on the journey with you. What is Fix Up? Let's just start with that.
Fix Up started about 7 years ago in 2013. It really started earlier, if you secretly want to know, because as I said, I was am a theatrical set designer. So I've been working with stuff and objects for my whole career, making stuff, buying stuff, schlepping it around the city, putting it on stage, taking it off stage, giving it to actors, all of that for years and years. But in 2013, I was on leave from all of that. I was home on maternity leave with our second son, and a bunch of stuff broke around our house, like a vacuum, a lamp, a toaster oven, my backpack, a bunch of stuff. And I remember thinking that it was super frustrating. I was very frustrated. I called the vacuum manufacturer and I said, how can I get this vacuum fixed? And they said, oh, bring it to our service center in Hackensack. So I live in New York, and I thought, I am not going to drive to Hackensack, New Jersey with a toddler and a newborn just to get this vacuum fixed. Like, that is absurd. But I was also stubborn, and I didn't want to get a new vacuum. I wanted that old vacuum to work, and the lamp and the toaster and all the other stuff. And I knew that it was probably possible, because in theater, we fix things all the time. If there's a lamp or a vacuum that needs to go out on stage, there's somebody in that theater who fixes it and gets it out on stage, and it works. So I thought, this could be done. It was like doubly annoying. The first thing I did then, I sat down, I wrote a letter to Walmart. Again, remember, sleep deprived, newborn baby. I wrote a letter to Walmart and I said, dear Walmart, basically you need to open a repair shop in the corner of every single Walmart worldwide, post haste. And I showed it to my husband. I was like ready to press send. And he said, do you think they're going to read your letter? I was like, of course they are.
This is important to me. Of course they're going to read my letter.
That's right. Of course they're going to change their entire business model because I said so.
Yeah.
And Michael was like, maybe slightly less sleep deprived. And he was like, maybe we should just gather just like a little bit of data before you press send. So I was like, fine. Okay. All right. So long story short, from there, we opened our first pop-up shop. We got an empty storefront in our neighborhood. We got a bunch of theater colleagues to come like play repair shop with us. And we opened our doors. We did not know if anyone was going to show up. We did not know if we were going to be able to fix anything. We did not know what to charge, but we did it. And lo and behold, they showed up, they brought their stuff, and we fixed it. And we seemed to have hit a nerve. People loved it. So we did another and another and another. Over 7 years, we did about 12 or 13 short-term repair shops all over New York City. And we just kept fixing and fixing. And we found that one of the consistent things was people's stories as they brought us their object. So they didn't just put their lamp down on the table and say, see you in a week. They told us about their lamp. They told us why they liked it, why they wanted it fixed. And I started piecing those stories, plus some of the knowledge and research of the impacts of consumption that I had been studying and working on my more academic side, and put all of these ideas into the book of fixation. Over the course of those 7 years, we fixed about 2,500 objects. We repaired 85% of them. We began making a small profit, which was fascinating. And I laid out in the book, hopefully, some clear steps forward for individuals, businesses, and policymakers.
Just speaking of policymakers, right to repair. Are you familiar with this phrase, the right to repair?
Yes, indeed.
So can you talk about that a little bit?
So right to repair is a movement to address practice in certain industries of making it difficult or impossible for owners or third-party repair providers to actually fix an object. So, for example, putting a proprietary screw on something so that you literally can't even open it, or making it void the warranty if you fix your own object. This applies to things like phones and tractors and a whole lot of other objects. And it also, even when not legally, it applies to certain things. Like, we got a lot of coffee makers that, like, you can't even open. So the right to repair movement is a really interesting legal battle, really, that's happening, that's about saying, wait a minute, what is ownership? Do I have the right to fix my own stuff? Do you have the right, after I've bought it, to make it impossible for me to fix it or modify it? And it's a really fascinating and important conversation.
And probably every person should just look in their state and figure out, do we have a right to repair law in our state? And if not, then they should research that and start pounding on somebody's door.
Yeah, and they can go to repair.org.
Repair.org. Thanks. That's a helpful insight. So before we go into your book, Fixation, I want to go back to Fix Up a little bit. I love this concept of let's do the experiment. So you said you set up your first pop-up shop and you just got some theater friends to come together. Did any of you have a certification in electronic repair or any of that stuff?
No. Actually, sorry. One member of our team, he did most of the appliances and the electronics, and he has had some certifications and some, like, quote unquote, professional training. But all the rest of us had years and years of training in theater and working backstage. So it's not like we were certified repair people, but we knew how to make things. And as you mentioned, we knew how to solve problems creatively. Repair is a very surprisingly creative act because nothing ever breaks the same way twice. We're also in theater, we're used to working on a budget and kind of making do with what you have. So there were some funny intersections, yeah, between the things we do in the costume shop or the prop shop and the things we had to do in the repair shop.
You ran this repair shop. You did it 12 or 13 times over 7 years. You made a little bit of profit. What do you think it was inside of you besides the fact of this frustration? So you've got this frustration. By golly, I'm not going to go buy a new vacuum. And you make a good point there too. A few years ago, it became a common practice for printer manufacturers to discount the printer so much that you could actually buy a new printer with printer cartridges installed. It cost you less than to go buy printer cartridges. It was just encouraging people to just throw your old printer in the basement and go get another one and hook it up and it'll print. And when that one runs out of ink, just go get a whole nother printer, right?
Yeah. Home printers are one of the worst offenders, most extreme examples of the system. Yeah.
What was it though, besides the fact that you were just stubborn, as you said, and that you were irritated a little bit, but what was it about? Why didn't you just go buy another vacuum? Why not?
Because I thought it was possible. I was stubborn, but I also, I guess, was hopeful. I thought it could be done. And I still think it can be done. That's why I'm still here, still talking about that stupid vacuum, is because we did it for 7 years at the level we could. I think it's possible at the next level up. I really believe that. I think it is possible for businesses to build reuse and repair into their business models and to make money doing it, or at least in the beginning to break even, and to transition their business models over time. So that letter to Walmart, I actually think it's possible. I actually think that Walmart can begin to sell used goods, to repair goods that they sell, and to transform their business model. And the reason I think it's possible, or one of the reasons, is it's happening. It is starting. In 2013, everybody laughed at me. And here we are in 2020, and IKEA has just launched this global buyback program.
Yeah, Patagonia does something similar, right? Doesn't Patagonia, if you buy a jacket from them and 5 years later you get a ripped elbow?
Patagonia, Eileen Fisher, REI, there's a few companies that are really out on the leading edge and have been for many years. Patagonia is really one of the strongest examples. But what's amazing now is to see other companies go there. A couple years ago, Macy's here in New York had a used Macy's boutique. That would have been unheard of a decade ago. The whole IKEA buyback program is a huge, big deal. It's happening all over the place, and it's really exciting and important.
One more time on your fix-up shop. I just want to stay here for a second. So it was pop-up shops to repair stuff and a wide range of stuff. People brought in all kinds of objects. I love that you said they didn't just bring the lamp, they brought the story. So that's important. It was mobile. And I think I heard you say at some point that it was structured like an event. There was something about the pop-up shop is coming and ta-da, here we are. So say more about that.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things that we did with our shops was we accidentally did a little disruption exercise, because the traditional model of repair is a fixed storefront in a neighborhood with a specialized repair person in it. And you might have five of those in a neighborhood historically. You'd have a cobbler, you'd have a jeweler, you might have an appliance guy and a cell phone guy, whatever. Doesn't matter. Each of the, certainly in New York, but also clearly across the country, that is not a tenable business model today, because each of those people paying rent in any given residential neighborhood where people can easily access the store, it's impossible. They can't compete. They can't compete, of course, and this is a topic for later, they can't compete because they're competing against the low price of new goods, i.e. the low wages being paid overseas for manufacturing. But so what we did that was interesting was we disrupted that model by bringing all those fixers under one roof. So essentially we were paying low rent or no rent because we also partnered with organizations. We were mobile. We never actually got a truck, like a food truck, but a repair truck, but it would have been an awesome next step. There are some challenges there, which for the real repair nerds among us, I'll be happy to go into. But we were mobile. We kept our overhead low in terms of rent. So we paid rent in the neighborhoods where we fixed, which was like our warehouse in Queens. And we paid little to no rent in the neighborhoods where we picked up the stuff. We brought all those specialized fixers under one roof. So that made one-stop drop-off for the customer, thereby eliminating another barrier. You don't have to do five errands. You just do one. And finally, this was really interesting, the event model worked really well. And that I didn't figure that out until the very end, because we did the events in the beginning because we had to, because we have jobs and kids and we were theater people. So we were used to doing like a show and then it's over. So we would substitute a repair shop for a show. We would, this month, instead of doing a show, I'm doing this repair shop. And then I go back to teaching or go back to another show. And then at some point I said, well, maybe we should be open all the time. Like maybe if it works for a 1 month pop-up, maybe we should be in operation all the time. And we tried it for 6 months. And interestingly enough, we ran into a problem that I call the dry cleaner problem, which is that if the dry cleaner is always going to be there, you could put off that errand and your dry cleaning might sit in a bucket or a basket in your house for like 3 months if you're me. And so the event quality created a sense of urgency where people were like, oh my God, the repair people are here. I'm coming. Did I miss them? And they would show up and bring all their stuff. And it helped us with volume, which was really important for us.
And just one more thing that you just said, you partnered with organizations. How critical was that? I hear people all the time say, I want to go do this thing. And I keep thinking to myself, well, there's somebody else over here is doing something related to what you're already doing. I don't understand why you don't partner. So talk to me about those partnerships.
The partnering for us was absolutely critical because we were so small and we had like no resources. Our first partner was the pharmacist who rented us his empty shop for free, and the Green Market that let us put up our tent there and sew buttons as a form basically of marketing. And then we got a little bigger and we partnered with like local businesses. We partnered with Patagonia in New York. They hosted us in their shop. We partnered with city agencies like Grow NYC to do pickups at the farmers market. So rather than trying to build our own infrastructure, we were able to, like, farmers market is a great example, to tap into that existing infrastructure in the community, provide a service for the partner, something good for their customers, brings people to the market, and tap right into the kind of correct customer base for our service. So the partnerships for us were really, really critical.
You've written a book now. You're a busy mom. You're an associate professor of practice in theater, and you're the director of sustainability and climate action at Barnard College. And you've been running this fix up, and I understand you put fix up on hiatus so you could get this done, but you've just kind of taken all that stuff that you've learned over the last 7 years and you've crammed it into this new book. And the book is called Fixation: How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. So what made you decide that a book was the next part of this evolution?
It was all those customers bringing their stuff and talking with us about it. As I listened to them, I realized there was a story here that was about more than repair or even this business model or even overconsumption or even climate change. There was a story about stuff that I was interested in telling, and I thought that I might have something new to add to the conversation because of this weird intersection of theater and repair and climate change work, like repair sits in the middle maybe. Because I spent so much of the first dozen years or whatever of my career really thinking about objects and how they create meaning on stage or how we can create meaning with them on stage. So I came into this project like an environmental warrior, but then I realized that my previous knowledge and understanding of stuff was actually relevant here, that we can't really tackle this question of climate change and consumption without understanding what is that story? Why do we have stuff? Why do we keep it? What does it do in our lives? And then how can we come up with these solutions and move forward?
Tell me about the book. What, first of all, who is it for?
Every author likes to say, my book is for anyone.
I bet your publisher wouldn't accept that answer
either. Right. The book is certainly aimed at people who are struggling with this system right now in the sense of maybe being a little overwhelmed with their stuff. Maybe they have too much of it, or they feel like the system is really all messed up and they don't feel good about it. It really is aimed at individuals and businesses and policymakers, because I don't think that you can just, there's a whole bunch of steps in the book that you can do on your own as a consumer, but they really work when you think about how the role of businesses and the role of policy. So maybe I should just tell you like what the book does a little bit.
Please,
and you can
please.
Figure
that
out
would be, that would be helpful. Yes, thanks.
So the book tells the story of the repair shops, and it's divided into 5 sections. And these sections were really inspired actually by Michael Pollan's work, because I look a lot at the food movement as a model and a place to learn from, because stuff is just like food. We extract resources from the earth, we transform it with our hands and our labor, and we bring it either into our bodies or into our homes. And the food movement is more advanced than what I like to call the stuff movement. So we have a lot to learn. And finally, these two things, stuff and food, are both totally critical and fundamental to our species. Every human culture has cooked food, religion, language, and stuff, right? Objects. I loved the way Michael Pollan wrote about the complexity of food and the joy of it. It's not a problem. Stuff shouldn't be seen only as a problem. It's a blessing. It's a joy. It helps us live our lives. It helps you have dinner with your kids. It's a good thing. And so to appreciate the kind of beauty and challenges, and then Michael Pollan laid out these steps forward. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah.
So I pick that up for stuff and I adapt it and I say, have good stuff, not too much, mostly reclaimed, care for it, pass it on. And so an object from the repair shops illustrates each of those steps of how we can move forward to basically do it better.
I love that. I have the sense that baby boomers are aging. And there is about to be the largest mass transfer of stuff from one generation to the next. At the same time, I'm also thinking about the fact that probably, and I don't know statistically if this is true, but at least in the last, let's say, decade or two, the storage unit industry has grown astronomically.
That is accurate.
We not only have stuff in our house, but we even have like special places to go put our other stuff. At some point, the kids are going to get the keys. First of all, for the generation getting ready to transfer that massive amount of stuff, how do we prepare our homes? How do we prepare ourselves for this mass transfer of stuff? And then the other side of that would be, how does the next generation prepare itself for this transfer of stuff? And how do we think about it?
This is a big one. Sadly, there's also a statistic sort of related to that transfer of stuff about how younger generations are increasingly less interested in taking on the objects of their that they inherit, essentially, or that get passed on. So in some ways, my call to action is a little bit more to the younger generation to say, get ready and embrace this. Don't buy that new stuff. Like, one of the core philosophies of my book is that buying new goods should become quite rare. That as individuals and as a society, we need to think of new goods as like pretty precious resource, heavy investment of resources and labor, and probably need to get pricier. And that we all need to rebalance our stuff diet. So Michael Pollan does a thing of eat plants, right? And it's challenging. I'd rather eat potato chips and bacon all day with some chocolate on top. But we all know now that that's not good and that we have to rebalance our food diet. Same thing. Buying new goods, especially cheap new goods, has to become like rare, a treat. And we have to radically increase our consumption of used goods. And then for the older generation, there's a whole chapter in the book about my grandmother, like at the end of her life, and how she really tried to begin that process of emptying her home, and how challenging it was for her. And then after she passed away, for the next generation to cope with it. I know a lot of people who've gone through that when they lose a parent, of that process of literally physically moving through this end of life process in stuff. It's crazy, but it's actually replicated at every point on the timeline. Like, you do it when you have a baby and all of a sudden you get a bunch of new stuff, and you get married and you merge your stuff, and you get divorced and you pull your stuff apart. Wow. And so I think I love that you raised it, because I think that's the first step, is to understand that it's there and it's valuable and we have to deal with it, and we can do it well, especially if we look really closely at what else is coming into our homes.
How can people find you or find your book, Fixation? How can they find you online?
Oh, my website is sandragoldmark.com.
What's something you would call on us to go and do as a result of this conversation?
The easiest call to action is really think about how many used goods you buy, and can you turn up that dial and turn down the dial of buying new across all categories: clothing, electronics, housewares, cars, whatever you can do. And for businesses, the call to action is to think about how they can support those activities in their business model. So if you're a company that sells stuff, can you actually begin thinking about re-commerce and service and repair? Can you begin making money by supporting these actions that we need individuals to take?
Sandra, thank you so much for being with us on Social Entrepreneur.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur. You can find the show notes, bonus material, and more at tonyloyd.com. That's TonyLoyd.com. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining me today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.